This is Bob Frelick, co-host of Thinking Clearly. We are a monthly show, and on this, our 84th episode, co-host Julia Minton and I looked back on our 7 years of broadcasting to find a mutually favorite episode, the Spotlight, by replaying it in its entirety. So here it is, originally broadcast mid-pandemic on October 7th, 2021, with our wonderful guest, journalist, deep thinker, and author, Jonathan Rauch. Enjoy.
For yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, and I'm here with the other host of this show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Well, Julia, let's kick it off as we usually do by telling folks how they can get in touch with us, give us feedback about the show, and suggest future guests, and how they can pop up our previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, well, as I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and we like hearing from you, our listeners. You can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Just search Thinking Clearly Radio, and we should come right up. You can find our promos as well as recorded versions of this show posted there. And of course, open up your favorite podcasting app and search for Thinking Clearly. We should come right up, and you can subscribe to all of our shows in the future, as well as 5 years now of shows that we've recorded.
Been a wonderful 5 years. Thank you. I want to thank you right at the start, Julia, just for hanging in here with this project that we've had here for the last 5 years.
Oh, it's a pleasure working with you, Bob, and the amazing guests that we have had.
And we have an amazing guest on this edition of Thinking Clearly. And here's a quote from our guest's recent book that we're going to be talking about on this episode. And this is a quote from Barack Obama. And it goes like this, quote, "If we do not have the capacity to distinguish what's true from what's false, then by definition, the marketplace of ideas doesn't work. And by definition, our democracy doesn't work. We are entering into epistemological crisis." So with that in mind, why don't you give us a little idea of what we're going to be covering in this episode, Julia?
Yeah, well, today's topic is how liberal science, reality-based communities, and the constitution of knowledge can help turn disagreement into truth.
Our guest for this episode is Jonathan Rauch. Jonathan is an experienced journalist. He's a deep thinker and an author of 8 books and numerous articles on a diversity of topics, including public policy and culture and government. And he's currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. And his latest book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth, captured my attention, stimulated many deep thoughts, and turned out to be a 2-highlighter book for me. Jonathan Rauch, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
I'm so happy to be here and happy to be a 2-highlighter book.
And Jonathan, I have to tell you, that's my highest rating too. Julie and I have this controversy about marking books, and I love to highlight books. I annotate books. I'm a fiend about that because I use those books as reference books, and I want to go back to them, and I want my annotations to be there. She's more of a purist that books are sacred. I don't know if I have that right about you, Julia, but this is a difference. So it's kind of an issue with her and I, but it was a 2-full highlighter.
I'm with you, Bob. I'm an annotator, and you can go back. I do go back 30 years later and find my annotations and refer to them. And there's a great tradition of marking up books, marginalia, that goes back to medieval times. My favorite is found in the illuminated manuscript in the margin. A monk had written, "God, give me bread and beer. Listen this time."
Thanks for joining us today. Our first question I have is, let's start with your views on the extent of the problem. Are we indeed, as Barack Obama suggested, entering into an epistemological crisis?
Yeah, we're not entering into one. We're in one. What President Obama did not know when he made that comment in, I think, October or November of last year, was that as of today, or about 6 months later, 8 months later, 65 to 70% of Republicans would believe that the election was stolen in 2020, a completely false alternative reality into which they've seceded. And just as worrisome in some ways, independents. A plurality of independents either believe that the election was stolen or that we'll never know for sure who the actual winner of the 2020 election was. So an epistemic crisis happens when a society can no longer not only agree on what's true, which people never agree on, but can't agree on how to resolve their differences anymore and try to arrive at some kind of consensus on what's true. And we're in one of those right now.
That's really much of what has prompted our show and much of what the focus of Thinking Clearly has been, is to flag the issues that are important to understand around this kind of crisis that we're in, which I call pollution of our information environment, and to give listeners some sort of hope and motivation to move beyond that. Well, the title of your book echoes your idea that we need to remedy this intense disagreement about truth and reality. And what we need to do is to recognize and adhere to a system of social rules. And you have a little quote in there saying, turning disagreement into knowledge. Why don't we take an in-depth look at what you actually mean by constitution of knowledge?
Well, I'd love to, needless to say, there are three really, I think, big important takeaways from my new book. One is that there is a constitution of knowledge. It's not just a marketplace of ideas. It's much more than that. It's a articulated, structured system that helps us find truth as a society. There are lots of rules, lots of institutions and norms that need to be followed to get this right. It doesn't just happen automatically if you have free speech. We need to understand it. We need to defend it, because big idea number two is you're being manipulated. And Bob, this is exactly what you just referred to. They're very powerful and effective techniques of information warfare. I call it epistemic warfare, that are being used against American society, against our American citizens right now, and they're working. And we need to understand that and defend ourselves, because this is not a problem that fixes itself automatically. And then the third big idea is they're not 10 feet tall, we are, which is if we get our act together, start understanding what's happening, and as you put it just now so well, clean up the information environment, I think we win. We do well. We come out okay. But if we don't get our act together, that's not so clear. Then maybe the other side wins. We go under in this deep conflict about truth and knowledge.
Well, Jonathan, I can reach over almost from where I'm sitting here and pull a book down from my bookshelf that tells me exactly what the Constitution is, what the Constitution of the United States is. Where do we get the rules, the articles, the guidelines for the Constitution of Knowledge?
Well, that's such a good point, because the Constitution of Knowledge, it's like the British Constitution in the sense that it's not formally written down, but it is a constitution. It is a set of rules and institutions that order our society. And what it is it's the systems that we rely on to keep ourselves collectively moored to reality as a society, and to enable us to settle differences of opinion, differences of belief, even differences of perception without going to war. It develops starting in the time of Isaac Newton and John Locke, and really takes off 150, 200 years later with the birth of modern science and journalism, medicine, academia, the other branches of what I call the reality-based community. And what it is a whole set of institutions and norms that explain how we're going to go about the truth-seeking business. Stuff like, it's actually very similar to the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is a way of basically forcing people to compromise with each other in a peaceful, non-coercive way in order to make laws. Well, we have the same problem in truth. You know, you're a Christian. I'm a Jew or a Muslim. We disagree. You believe one thing about abortion or guns. I believe a different thing. How do we settle that without going to war? That's what the Constitution of Knowledge does. It says we're going to submit all our ideas to a big social process, lots of people institutions are going to check each other. We're going to have checks and balances. We're literally going to check each other's opinions. We're going to pit biases against biases. Anyone can say or believe anything, but in order to qualify as knowledge, their beliefs have to go through this exhaustive social process. Lots of checking, lots of structure, everything from peer review and academia and journals and journalism. Law has, you know, legal briefs and courts. Government has administrative procedures. Lots of stuff you're going to have to do to establish that something is a fact for public purposes that people can actually, governments, for example, can actually act on, actually belongs in the textbooks. Well, all of that stuff in there, it's not just a free-form marketplace of ideas. That's the constitution of knowledge. It tells us how we're going to do that business of constructing our public objective knowledge, our reality, the things that we need to have a consensus on in order to function in a society, like, for example, who won the 2020 election.
The key words there, consensus was one, but there are a couple other key concepts related to the constitution of knowledge. You mentioned one of them, reality-based communities, the other being liberal science. Can you get into that a little bit and describe what reality-based communities are and what you mean by liberal science?
Yeah, sorry about all the jargon. It's actually reality-based community, singular, and that's what's unique about the constitution of knowledge. Anyone can join anywhere in the world, regardless of color, creed, race, language. Everyone's following the same rules, and there's really only one reality-based community under constitution of knowledge. And it doesn't mean everyone believes the same thing, but they're following generally the same set of rules, and that's why it's possible for scientists from all over the world to basically pivot in a matter of hours, participate in decoding the genome of the coronavirus, and literally within a couple weeks, design a virus. There are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of great minds that work on that in institutions. So they're all part of the reality-based community. The reality-based community is the people, the institutions, mostly the professionals who are following these rules. And there are four big pillars. I mean, there are lots of other people who are involved. But the four big ones are academia, science, and research, number one. That's the one we all think of firsthand. You know, those are the researchers in the labs. But the second is the one that I come from, and that's journalism. And that's also a reality-based community because we are supposed to be checking stuff to find out if it's accurate, correcting each other, running corrections. If we're wrong, organizing research. We call it investigative reporting, inculcating others, younger people in these same norms, trying to get it right. Third big community in the reality-based community is law. People don't realize this. I didn't until I wrote this book. But the idea of a fact originates not in science, but in law, precedes fact, because in order to go to court and get some kind of agreement or settlement or judgment, you had to have some common account of what was actually true, what actually happened that day. That's where the notion of a fact came from. And the fourth big one is government. That's everything from the intelligence agencies, which are fact-driven, to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which makes the weather reports, which, as you recall, Donald Trump tried to falsify. Administrative law, that's what requires that regulations be based on facts. You can, if a regulation is based on made-up facts, you can go to court and get it struck down. So all of those four things are what keep us as a society moored to reality instead of mired in these alternative worlds of nonsense.
And liberal science now, let's clarify that a little bit. Is there something called conservative science?
No, liberal science is a term I used in my first book about this, which is 28 years ago. I never really loved that word. And I was trying to look for a word that's, you know, people talk about science, they think about chemistry and physics and maybe sometimes math. And I was looking for something broader because I wanted to make the point, modern society, free societies, productive, constructive, peaceful societies depend on what we call liberal institutions. And those are rules-based institutions. Instead of having a rule by a ruler, say a monarch or a priest or whatever, you have rule by rules. And I was trying to say, you know, we're all familiar with the two biggies of liberalism. One is free markets, which make our economic decisions, and the other is liberal democracy, and that makes our political decisions. But I said there's a third, and it's as great, if not greater, than the other two, and that's liberal science. And that's this whole global network people who are testing ideas to find out which are true, checking them, checking each other, writing the textbooks, figuring out the credentials and the rules. And I said, well, I'm going to call all that liberal science because it's bigger than just physical science. And it works on liberal principles. 28 years later, I'm figuring, you know, a better way to think about this is the constitution of knowledge, because that's what's really uniting all of these groups and the reality-based community, who are the people and institutions who are actually doing it. But they're all ways of talking about the same thing, which is our modern liberal fact-based reality-building, knowledge-making system.
You talk about two distinguishing characteristics of liberal science, the fallibilist rule and the empirical rule. Can you help us understand how these rules set the standard for liberal science and hence the constitution of knowledge?
Yeah, this is the most audacious thing I ever did. I was 33 years old. I published a book called Kindly Inquisitors, New Attacks on Free Thought. That was my debut of this concept of liberal science. And amazingly, I said that basically there's tons and tons of things that liberal science does. And they, you know, every sector does something different that's characteristic of itself. But they all have two things in common, these two rules. Rule number one, fallibilist rule. It says no one gets the final say. And that means that all knowledge is provisional. It just might possibly conceivably be wrong. It can be established, well-grounded for a very long time, checked and checked and rechecked again. So it's not like we start from scratch every morning, but we always have to open ourselves to the possibility that we might be wrong. And that's a revolution in human affairs. Because until that rule came along about 300 years ago, we assumed that knowledge was what we're certain of, that you cannot question. Well, fallibilist rule is also a social rule because it's where we get free speech. It's the justification for people being able to question all kinds of received wisdom. It says we might lose knowledge if we stymie questioning that might actually turn out to show us an error. So the second big rule, just as revolutionary, I call it the empirical rule, but it's no personal authority. So this says, okay, so once you have free speech, open inquiry, how are you going to figure out which of these contending beliefs out there are true or close to true? Which are knowledge? So information is cheap and plentiful and mostly wrong, but knowledge is precious and rare and extremely hard to find. How do you sort through it? Well, you have to have a process of checking to see what's right and what's wrong. Well, how do you do that? Well, I could ask an oracle, or I could appoint a priest who says, by divine revelation, I declare that X is true and Y is false. And if you're a heretic, we'll burn you at the stake. You could have a Politburo do it. So it was done in the Soviet Union. But all of those systems privilege one particular authority or tribe. And liberal science threw all that away. It said, no, wait a minute. In order to show that something's true, you're going to have to be able to persuade no one in particular. Any reasonable person should be able to replicate that experiment, look at the facts and find the same thing. There's no merely personal authority. You're going to get your authority by performing an experiment that anyone else can perform, by exposing your logic so that other people can contest it. Well, that's also a revolutionary social principle, because that suddenly says, if making knowledge is open to any reasonable person anywhere in the world, we all become interoperable as human beings. And that means literally hundreds of millions of people from around the world of different races, colors, creeds, genders, languages, they can all plug into this gigantic social knowledge building network that we can now build on interoperable rules. And that's the magic formula that allows you to have literally hundreds of millions of minds working to create knowledge in a self-organized fashion. This is literally, Julia, a species transforming technology. This is what takes us from the world where we're gathered in small tribes and we believe a few things and they're dogmatic and they may be true, they may be false, but they're not very functional, to a world in which literally, I couldn't prove this, but I believe it is true that on any given morning in the modern reality-based community, we discover more knowledge than in the entire first 200,000 years of human history. That's how explosively productive this system is. And it, because of those two rules, no one gets to shut down the argument, and everyone needs to be able to check anyone else.
it's great to distinguish between information and knowledge. This gets me thinking about, you mentioned the liberal science, and we just talked about those two rules that are kind of the starting points for liberal science. It hasn't aired yet, but this coming month, we had a second-time guest, Lee McIntyre, and I think you know Lee because you quoted him a number of times in your book. Lee wrote a book called The Scientific Attitude. What you would describe is not necessarily the scientific method in our thinking, but the scientific attitude, which include the fallibist rules and evidence-based rules.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Lee's. I've learned so much from him, quote him in the book. We've co-authored together actually an article for the Washington Post. So I'm thrilled that you've had him on a show, on your show, and I'm delighted to join you. And what Lee emphasizes is that what defines science, broadly defined, liberal science, isn't any particular thing that people do in a laboratory, for example. It's this attitude that they have that takes seriously the two rules that we just talked about, that anyone should be able to check you and no one gets to completely end the argument. And then I add to that, I take that even a step further and say that the magic really is not even in the individual attitudes, because lots of working scientists are very dogmatic and don't change their minds even when they should. Albert Einstein rejected quantum theory because he said he just couldn't accept that God plays dice. The real magic is in the community, because if the community follows those rules, then a lot of the individuals can be dogmatic and stick to their points of view and argue it fiercely. In fact, you want them to do that. That's where you get the energy to carry on these disputes and vigorously pursue them. But as long as the community follows these rules and doesn't let anyone shut down the argument and doesn't let anyone say, well, my tribe is the privileged tribe, then you're going to get something that looks a lot like modern science, the modern knowledge building industry.
I want to remind listeners that we are talking to Jonathan Rauch, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and author of The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. And it's great to have the ideal of reality-based communities and the constitution of knowledge, but unfortunately, as we've talked about, there are many groups and individuals that don't constrain themselves to those rules and standards of liberal science and reality-based community. And your book is an equal opportunity critique of trolls and fake news and former President Trump, pertaining mostly to the right, and cancel culture and other means of censorship associated largely with the left. So let's wade into some of your thoughts on those topics.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thinking back to my roadmap, we've talked about important point number one, which is it's not just a marketplace of ideas. It is a constitution of knowledge. It's a whole system with a lot of structure. Got to understand it, got to defend it. And that's because of the reason you just named, which is point number two, you're being manipulated. The constitution of knowledge has always had enemies from day one. You can think of the Catholic Church putting Galileo under house arrest because he committed the Copernican heresy. It always will have enemies for a lot of reasons. It's a very unsettling system. It gets in the way of demagogues and dictators by putting inconvenient truths in their paths. It's unpredictable. It's sometimes disrespectful of what people think are their cherished norms and truths. The big problem today, when I say you're being manipulated, what I mean by that is different forms of what people call information warfare, or I call it epistemic warfare. Well, okay, so what's that? So that's the organization and manipulation of the media and information environments in order to get political advantage. And specifically, what people are trying to do when they use these methods is to divide and dominate and disorient and ultimately demoralize a target population by making them feel chilled so they can't speak out and so that no one knows what anyone else really thinks anymore, by flooding the system with false information so people can't tell which end is up, by using techniques like trolling, which is attention hijacking. That's, you know, if I attack your most cherished belief or your group or your sense of justice, you're going to feel outraged. You're going to feel impelled to defend yourself. even if what I'm doing is just basically designed to grab your attention and seize it. Conspiracy theories are part of that. Another big one is the so-called fire hose of falsehood. This is a Russian technique that was adopted and then perfected and applied to the U.S. by Trump and his MAGA movement. And that's just putting out so many lies and half-truths and exaggerations and conspiracy theories at such a high rate through so many channels that the media can't keep up and the public throws up its hands, says, I don't know who's right or who's wrong anymore. I can't tell. I give up. So those are just some of the tactics that are now in use. The left is predominantly using canceling social coercion. The right is predominantly using disinformation. But you could just as easily swap those and have throughout history. Both extremes have used all of these methods. Social media has turbocharged them, and here we are.
One of the things that glares out at me is that we have this situation where this is almost hard for me to describe. I'm so emotional about it at times. But how do we get out of the situation we're in? In other words, people that are members of the reality-based community and adhere to the constitution of knowledge. But how do we overwhelm the loud trumpeting voices of people who are willingly and aggressively politicizing and weaponizing information?
That's a whole discussion because there's so much to do and so much to think about there. And, you know, I hate to say this, Bob and Julia, I wish it weren't the case, but in a liberal democracy like ours, the best strategy against disinformation and social coercion and canceling is not to do them in the first place.
Yeah.
And we did a good job of keeping them out of our politics between about 1865 and basically 4 years ago, 5 years ago. The last huge outbreak of disinformation was before the Civil War. It's used by the South to gin up war fever. Then people kind of realize what dangerous tactics these are. But they're here. So what do we do? Well, the first thing we need to do is understand that we're under attack. And surprisingly, a lot of people don't realize that. You know, in my circles, people walk around and say, well, why are we so polarized? Why are we so divided? Why do these people believe these crazy things? What's gone wrong? Well, maybe it's lack of trust in our institutions, or it's stagnant working class white male wages, or it's the decline of authorities like religion, or it's institutions have stopped working well. And I have time for all those conversations, but the starting point needs to be that for the past number of decades, but especially in the past 4 or 5 years, America has been, the Constitution of Knowledge has been under a sustained, concentrated, very sophisticated attack by players who can gain politically by disrupting it, demoralizing it, knocking it down. We got to realize that. We've got to stop being naive about the tactics that are being used against us. These are tactics perfected by the Russians, but we've never seen them deployed on a mass scale by Americans against other Americans. So we got to wake up to that. And second, we got to realize that there is a Constitution of Knowledge and understand its principles and start defending them more vigorously than we have. We've been too quick to blame ourselves and say, well, you know, there's all kinds of problems in academia and science, and there are, of course, and in journalism. But we also got to understand that there is only one system that exists that within less than a year can build from scratch a vaccine that's preventing me from COVID right now. All of these other forces we're talking about, they're parasitic, they're anarchistic, they're nihilistic. They're only good at tearing down. They can't actually create knowledge. All they can do is undermine the systems that do create knowledge. So we got to be vigorous in our defense. So then we get to the specific things, but I should probably pause for breath before we get into, you know, what do we fix social media? What does the media need to do? How about academia? What about cancel culture? There's lots of different things that need to happen in lots of spheres. And that's where the story gets, you know, we get down to brass tacks, but maybe I should take a breath before I launch into all of that.
I want to get into some detail about that before we wrap this episode up, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. Thinking about your book that laid some of this out first, The Kindly Inquisitors, and now The Constitution of Knowledge, I was thinking that you might make this into a trilogy, and the third book would be the specifics, the road forward to make this all happen. I mean, there are many people that are working on this in different ways. Tristan Harris, who is working on trying to change and regulate the technologies and make them more humane and more customer friendly, rather than collecting our information and using that to manipulate us. And we did have a program with Bill Doherty from Braver Angels, and I know you cited Braver Angels in your book. They're working on trying to get people from the left and the right to get into more civil dialogue and engage each other. What really needs to happen, and the frustration that I have sometimes, is there's a lot of people, but they're working on different aspects of this whole problem. And how do we get those folks together? And I'd like to spend a little more time talking about that. But before we do, while you're catching your breaths, we might change topics a little bit, and then we'll get back to this. So Julia has a question.
In addition to, of course, buying your book, Constitution of Knowledge, to fill in a lot of the background and context that we haven't had time to talk about today, what can our listeners do to use the ideas that we've been discussing to help clean up our information ecosystem, as well as their own perception of knowledge versus information?
Well, you guys are both asking kind of two parts to the same question. So this is a good place for the conversation to be, because what I like to say is that they're kind of two big levels that we're going to need to focus on in order to get out of this mess. And within each of those, there are a lot of little individual things that different institutions and people need to do in different ways, depending on their context. But the two big categories are the top-down stuff. And those are the institutional changes that need to be made. And that's everything from university cultures that embrace more ideological diversity so that there's more alternatives to progressive worldviews, universities adopting free speech principles like the Chicago principles, journalists becoming better at understanding and covering disinformation, which we're already seeing. But lots of institutional changes. And then there's the other end of the stick, just as important. That's the individual stuff. That's what Julia's referring to. Those are the things we can do in individuals in our own information environments. And those are things like, before you retweet, can you please make sure it's accurate? Bother to check it, because every time people retweet false information, it just gets more velocity. That's something individuals can do. If you see someone being canceled, that is being the target of a campaign of vilification or shaming in order to silence them and intimidate them, and also, frankly, to intimidate you, you're the real target of that because they're just the example. Well, don't let that happen. Speak out against it. Become a public advocate of that person who's being canceled. Go to them and say, how can I help you and support you? In your own environment, if you're part of a knowledge-making business, you know, if you're in a newsroom environment or in an academic environment, for example, be a champion of intellectual diversity. The knowledge-making system doesn't work if everyone has the same biases. It has to pit bias against different bias, or else we can't find errors because we never see our own errors. We don't see our own biases. So be a champion of intellectual diversity. It should be right up there, completely co-equal with racial and ethnic and other kinds of diversity. Don't shut up. You know, if people come and try to silence you and say you're not qualified because of your color or race or creed to participate in a conversation, well, participate anyway. You'll be surprised how big a difference that will make in reducing the effectiveness of cancel culture. You mentioned already an important one that I've been part of, and that's the Braver Angels Project, which is a national grassroots depolarizing effort. Well, I think, well, what does that have to do with information warfare? The answer is, you remember I said that what epistemic warfare is out to do is disorient, divide, dominate, and demoralize. Well, the divide is maybe the key one there. That's what Vladimir Putin was doing when he was using his trolls in St. Petersburg to stimulate protests across the street from each other. He's trying to divide and weaken our society, because a divided society is easier to propagandize, and propaganda further divides the society, vicious spiral. Well, Braver Angels comes along and sees this and says, let's reverse the spiral. We can get people talking to each other more, trusting each other more. They don't all have to share the same beliefs. but then they will be less susceptible to the division and demagoguery and propaganda. So creating more social trust actually makes our society more resilient against attacks, information warfare attacks. So these are all things that can be done, and they're more specifically like social media. The bad news is it's a wicked hard problem because social media is designed to monetize eyeballs regardless of truth. So that's really bad design. The good news is that compared to 5 years ago, we're much better off because the smartest minds in Silicon Valley are now trying to figure out how to change the way these platforms operate that will make them less hostile to truth. You know, things like Twitter will now throw up an interstitial warning, it's called. If you try to retweet something without reading it first, they'll say, do you want to read this? So these seemingly small behavioral changes turn out they can have a large impact in slowing us down, making us think a little bit harder, being a bit more consistent, and a bit more compassionate. So lots of stuff like that. I could go on and on because there's so many. But that's really the good news, Bob and Julia, which is there are so many opportunities to do things better than we're doing now. And there's in every sphere of life, there are things that we can improve and work on.
You've hit the nail on the head as to what's out there. And we have actually done, I think it was a three-part series on vetting information, talking about not passing on information until you've vetted it, until you've checked it out, checked the sources and that kind of thing. And we developed a kind of a single page guide to doing that. And some people will do that, but look at the pandemic that we're in and look at the difference in these graphs. We have a graph for Humboldt County here that shows the amount of positive tests related to vaccinated, fully vaccinated, and unvaccinated folks. And it's such a graphic curve, the steep rise of positive cases in unvaccinated cases ought to just convince people, just that visual alone, convince people that it's important to get vaccinations. And still there are people, I read a tweet by somebody recently saying something to the effect of, if we go along with getting vaccinated, then we're going to have to go along with everything. It's kind of like the, you know, the government or the move and the cultural change is out to force people into a certain lifestyle or a certain cultural set of ideas, and people are resisting that. So those folks that are so politically motivated in that way, how do we actually get those folks to say, wait a minute, the most important thing is to find ways to arrive at a shared reality and shared facts and shared truths, and then we'll negotiate it out with the constitution of knowledge and like braver angels getting together with other folks that have different viewpoints. That's where my frustration actually comes out, is to actually make that point graphically enough so that people say enough is enough.
Well, that's a hard problem. But the good news is I think you don't need everyone. You just need a critical mass of people who are on board with the constitution of knowledge. And, you know, it's interesting you raised vaccination. Now, there's a specific conversation we can have about COVID vaccination, why it's not happening and what to do about that. I favor actually paying people to get vaccinated. I think that's a move we should have started doing months and months ago. But set that aside, there's actually a whole new discipline that's forming around epistemic immunity, which is, so you've got these bad ideas out there. And they operate like viruses. One of them is anti-Semitism, which for whatever reason is a human information virus that goes back now 2,000 years and just keeps popping up again and again. Anti-vax has turned out to be another. It just keeps popping up, and it's promulgated by groups that are using very clever approaches and technologies to push it. So people are saying, well, this is a lot like actual viruses, like biological viruses. So how do we build more epistemic immunity in the population? How do you make them more resistant? You're never going to completely stamp out the viruses, the information viruses, the bad ideas. This leads to thinking about stuff like what Tristan Harris talks about, making social media design so it's less quick to transmit the bad stuff, so it doesn't move it around as fast. Create kind of epistemic fire gaps in the population. trusted people who can in communities who can talk to people in trusted ways. This might be the pastor, for example. It might be your personal physician who can weigh in. But using those nodes of trust to try to slow down the disinformation. Stuff like, I think you talked about this, with media literacy, civics education, helping people, writing guides like, frankly, the one you wrote sounds fantastic. Just helping people become more internally resistant so that they can do a better job of sorting the viral material from the benign material. So there's actually a whole discipline developing around how you can reduce this kind of viral spread. And as I said, the bad news is you never get rid of it, and you don't even really want to in a free society. You want to live in a world where people are free to, you know, believe that Elvis is still alive. But you do want to engineer the system so that you can amplify the good stuff and disamplify or slow down the bad stuff, the harmful stuff. And that's the challenge we're facing.
I'm looking for a way to sort of unite all these different
aspects. Yeah, you can't. Aspects. You shouldn't try. Yeah, you need to give up on that. I need to give up on that. You know, that's the hardest thing about talking about this book. This is my eighth book, and the last one was on happiness. And you could summarize it, and then you could say, here are the four things. And we all just crave the four bullet points that solve the problem, but they're not out there. We've been through stuff like this in the past, Bob. This is not the first time. The printing press caused a huge information disruption and led to 150 years of warfare across Europe, fantastically brutal and bloody, and it ultimately led to the development of the Constitution of Knowledge. But more recently, in American society, we went through this in the 19th century. American media was a cesspool, you know, a toxic waste dump of extreme hyperpartisanship and fake news. You know, they put all kinds of stuff in the newspaper, just crazy stuff. And it became a toxic environment. And people began to realize it had to change. And changing that took a lot of changes up and down the line. But you had, for example, the creation of the American Society of Newspaper Editors in the early 20th century. They promulgated ethics codes and norms and professional standards like don't make stuff up. Check stuff before you put it in the paper. If it's wrong, run a correction. Well, that seems obvious, right? But someone had to think about it. It wasn't standard until then. You got professionalized newsrooms. You got journalism schools were opened up and began promulgating these norms and rules, training people in better ways to do it. You got prizes like the Pulitzer, which a National Magazine Award, lots of others, which incentivized good behavior. And it took about generation to two generations, but in that time we moved from William Randolph Hearst, you know, the famous yellow press baron who supposedly said, who started the Spanish-American War, said, you provide the pictures, I'll provide the war. He didn't really say that, but it sums up the attitude. In a couple of generations, you go from that to Edward R. Murrow and the great journalistic establishments of the mid and late 20th centuries. So that's what we got to do again. But it's not like there's any one thing. It's going to be society-wide reactions of all kinds of institutional adaptations, everything from the attitude of reporters in the media, the establishment of internet observatories. There's now a global community of people who are in institutions that are monitoring the disinformation networks going inside, understanding it's going to require civics education. It's going to require changing the way platforms operate. It's going to require personal attitudes like depolarization, like braver angels, which you mentioned. I could go on. But that's the whole point. And that's the good news. There's so much to work on in so many angles. And if we get through this thing, it's going to be because enough people did enough things in their own worlds, in their own institutions, to make them friendly to the Constitution of Knowledge.
Well, good counsel, Jonathan. Thank you.
I hope that's not discouraging.
No. What I take from that is the counsel is take a deep breath, have patience, and keep working.
And keep working. And do what you can. Remember, we have huge advantages. That's the third big lesson of my book, which I mentioned. They're not 10 feet tall, we are. So canceling disinformation caught us by surprise. We weren't ready because things seemed to be going so well for so long. We forgot we even had a Constitution of Knowledge. We figured, well, free speech, that's enough. The rest takes care of itself. We were not ready for this attack. But this is not a surprise attack anymore. People have figured out what's going on with Russian disinformation and with Trump's fire hose of falsehood and cancel culture. You're starting to see progressives who are pushing back against cancel culture, for example. You're starting to see the creation of many organizations on the ground that are pushing back in places like universities and getting employers not to fire people when they're canceled in many different walks of life, education and school. So the surprise, the advantage of surprise is gone. And that's a big deal. And here's another big thing that people should take heart from. The reality-based community has the world's most powerful ally, which is reality. What's happening to the Republican Party right now is they are going so far down the MAGA rabbit hole of the election was stolen. They're now saying a majority of Republicans are saying that the Democrats are to blame for the Capitol Hill riots. This is an alternative reality that becomes dysfunctional very quickly. And when you lose touch with reality, that is a big disadvantage in any kind of situation where you're contending for power. Well, one advantage of the reality-based community is it is pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good at keeping itself rooted in reality. We are the only people in this argument who can put that COVID vaccine in people's arm. Now, getting people to take it is hard for all the reasons we're talking about. You mentioned, Bob, we do have the reality of COVID out there. And at some point, more and more people do start to look at that and saying, do I really want to get sick? So it's a battle. I don't want anyone to feel complacent. I always say I'm not optimistic. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that if we get organized and begin pushing back against this multi-front war on truth, I think we do win, but that's all based on the condition that we got to get our act together.
Yeah, and I guess a question I would have, it's a little bit of a sideline, but coming back to reality-based community, a lot of trust has been eroded in reality-based community and in the facets that make that up. What do we do to rebuild that eroded trust people have in the very sources of reality?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because I've been emphasizing attacks from the outside, but part of what we've also seen is corruption from the inside, or at least a kind of decay from the inside. So we have some work to do to clean up our own house. What I'm thinking about there is the longest pole in the tent of the reality-based community, the inner sanctum is the world of academia, which is where the science and research primarily go on. And we're seeing some interlocking problems in academia. One is in some disciplines, lack of enough intellectual diversity to surface all the questions. You're just seeing so fields in which there's so many progressives and so few conservatives that questions aren't being asked. And there's now well-documented discrimination against conservatives. It's often not even intentional. It's like, you know, people just hire people like themselves. Classic example. Well, that's harming the reputation of academia because more and more people think it's a progressive racket. You know, it's about indoctrination. And got to do a much better job of ensuring that academia is a welcoming place, a non-hostile, in fact, welcoming place for diverse viewpoints, including conservative viewpoints, libertarian viewpoints, religious viewpoints. Got to do better on that. Got to do better about not letting social justice causes politicize academic research, because that's causing a lot of lack of trust in society. And it's also, I think, damaging the scientific product itself. And too much of academia is allowing canceling to go on. What does happen typically is if a student files a complaint against a professor saying the student was offensive or professor was, you know, emotionally abusive or whatever, is a long investigation, which, you know, even if the professor comes out at the end okay, the investigation is the punishment. A better attitude, one that's exemplified recently, for example, by the University of Chicago, is when some student complains that a professor has said something hurtful or offensive, say, well, that's too bad. We call that education. When you begin to stand up to the cancelers, they lose their ability to manipulate the environment by weaponizing things like investigations and course reviews and using social media to hammer students who they think get out of line. So that's work that has to be done inside the reality-based community. In journalism, I think we need to do a better job than we're doing lately of separating fact from opinion. There's too much opinionizing going on. Twitter has had a kind of a corrupting influence on journalists, and we have ourselves to blame for that. And we too in journalism need to do a better job of intellectual diversity, bringing in voices not just of ethnic minorities, but also political minorities, people who have different views than our own. It should not be the case that at a newspaper like the New York Times, an editor gets fired for running a conservative op-ed piece. That should not be going on at our leading newspaper. So we have some work cut out for ourselves in order to regain that trust. And can't overemphasize, it's no good just to do the work, the outward-facing work. We got to do the inward-facing work too.
Well said. Jonathan, thank you for your optimism. I'm usually the perpetual optimist.
He's not an optimist. He's hopeful.
I'm not an optimist yet, but I'm hopeful. If we do these things right, I think then I'll be an optimist.
No, well, I'm usually, between Julie and I, I'm the perpetual optimist in terms of the long term. I look at what's happening right now. I tend to look at that as lots of cultural change going on, and it's just kind of a expected reaction to the cultural change. That helps me gain some perspective into what's going to happen in the long run, that we're going to work our way through this period towards better and more thoughtful times. So I do thank you for your optimistic, hopeful words. And one of the things
Bob's such an optimist, he wants to view other people as optimists.
and one of the things that came through to me in what you were saying is that it's in our best interest as human beings, and we have actually evolutionarily developed into creatures that survive because we accurately test reality. That's a big part of our survival. That helps us understand what the world is like out there, and to adapt to it and survive and thrive in it. And so that is something that came across in what you said, is that those folks that are getting so apart from reality hopefully will begin to realize it's not in their best interest to get that far away from reality. It's not worth it just to politicize and weaponize information because they're afraid of the cultural change that's going on. So those were some hopeful words. One of the things that I was interested in and got to thinking about is that everyone who writes a book is out talking about it, thinking about it, discussing the book, and you've done, I'm assuming, a number of podcasts, talk shows, etc., to do that. One of the things that I wondered about is, from doing that and when questions come up, what have you learned?
Well, here's a truly optimistic note, not just hopeful, but optimistic. This is my most challenging book intellectually. There are lots of moving parts. If you've read it, you know that it doesn't shy away from epistemology. There's philosophy of science in there. There's a lot of material. I packed it in. And I kind of thought this book will be an obscure book and maybe someone will discover it in 10 or 20 years. Because actually, that's what happened with Kindly Inquisitors, my first book on this subject. Well, I have been amazed, Bob, and so impressed that there is such an appetite out there for people who really want to understand in detail, in the hard tacks, not just the, you know, quick political takes. They want to understand what is happening to us. What is driving this epistemic succession, this, where people descend into these alternative conspiratorial alternative realities? What's going on with the polarization? Who is doing this to us? How are they doing it? I get on shows like this one, and people do exactly what you do. They say, explain the constitution of knowledge. And they don't want the bumper sticker. They say, so what are these two rules and how do they work? And I'm so impressed by that because, you know, maybe it's drawing on an unrepresentative sample, but I think that people are hungry to figure out what's gone wrong and figure out how to fix it. I think that's what's leading Braver Angels to be, it's now in every state. It's a completely volunteer grassroots movement that's just taking off. So I think that you guys on this show are part of a larger civic revival of interest in where truth comes from and how to defend it. And I'm optimistic about that because I did not expect that. I did not expect so many people to be so interested.
In doing the various talks that you've done and interviews, is there something that you would like to revise your book that you wish you would have added?
It's always a good question. There's something I would do differently, and I'll tell you what it is, and it's going to sound partisan, so I'll preface it by saying I'm the least partisan person you'll ever meet. I have voted for many Republicans. My politics are probably center-right. Here's what I would change. I wrote the book with the notion that you've got kind of two balanced threats from the outside. One is predominantly from the left, cancel culture. That's the use of social coercion to intimidate and silence and create false consensus. And the other is disinformation. And that's MAGA, Putin, Trump. And I thought they were about equal, but I thought, since I had to finish the book before the election, two-thirds chance Joe Biden will be president and Donald Trump will go away and his tactics will go away with him. And by June of 2021, when my book comes out, people, you know, will look at all this stuff about Trump and Republicans and think, well, that's over. And it would look obsolete. Here's what I did not understand, which is starting in April of 2020, Donald Trump and his MAGA movement begin an information attack on mail-in voting. You remember this, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said this is mail-in voting is a Democratic plot to steal the election. And I was puzzled by that because a lot of Republicans and older voters vote by mail, thought this isn't in their interest. What I missed is that they were not targeting the election. They were targeting the post-election. They were creating the messaging and setting up the networks that they were going to be ready to activate on November 4th if they lost. They lost. They activated the network. They launched the most widespread, audacious, and successful disinformation campaign that's ever been waged in America, used every channel, including broadcast media, print media, social media, the White House, Republican Party officials, and they even used the courts as vehicles for disinformation. And they convinced approximately 70% of Republicans that the election was stolen. In other words, that America is no longer a democracy. We have never seen an information attack on that scale of that success, at least not since the 1850s, which, as you recall, ended very badly. We're seeing it now. The cat is out of the bag. We're now finding in places like Arizona, my home state, with the so-called election audit, that you can, the Republican Party and others, the MAGA movement, can go right on doing these tactics, even if Trump is not personally leading them. So if I could write it over today to get to your question, I would say that these threats that I saw as comparable, I would no longer say they are. I would say the threat from disinformation and MAGA world is really the more dire of the two.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, the sound is just about out of our hourglass here, Jonathan. So I would really love to have another hour with you, but time is up for us, and it's been a great conversation. I want to thank you very much for sharing your ideas about reality-based community and the constitution of knowledge as means of moving out of this current dysfunctional communication and offering a possible path forward to defending objective truth and free inquiry. So our Facebook page is, will post links to your book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth, and to your webpage, jonathanrauch.com. That's RAUCH.com. And your page at Brookings. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Jonathan?
No, but I just do want to thank you both for having me on the show and for the wonderful job that you're doing of taking all of these ideas seriously, diving deep, not flinching from these conversations. It is a civic blessing to all of us.
Thank you very much. And a big thanks to our listeners. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, welcome, Jonathan, for joining us.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.